Hello, folks. I'd like to welcome you to LRIS's monthly podcast, First Thursday. My name is Will Aitchison. I'm going to be your host while we cover recent developments in public safety, labor relations, and boy, do we have a chock-full month. Cases from all over the country involving a wide variety of issues. But I want to start with what I think of as a bombshell Brady case out of Texas. Let me just set the stage a little bit for you here. When I say Brady case, I'm talking about a case that arises under the Supreme Court's long ago decision, more than 50 years old decision in Brady versus New Jersey. And the Brady rule, as we've come to know it, requires the prosecution to disclose to a criminal defendant any information that potentially is exculpatory. That principle applies to impeachment evidence and thus applies to law enforcement personnel files. So if a police officer is scheduled to testify in a case, there's an obligation on the part of the employer to disclose to the district attorney's office certain types of information. And usually that information is information related to either complaints or findings that the officer has been untruthful or is biased or may have perception problems and the like. The Brady rule has been expanding across the country. It seemed to grow out of Southern California, but it's really all over the place now. Still kind of hit and miss geographically. You can find one prosecutor who cares a whole lot about the Brady rule right next door to another prosecutor who pretends it doesn't exist. But you can pretty much say that the Brady rule in one form or another exists in virtually every state in the country. And constitutionally, it probably has to. As the Brady rule has evolved, it's been very curious to see the reaction of law enforcement agencies to one of their employees having a Brady designation where potential disclosure of disciplinary materials may be required. That's not necessarily the end of things. All a Brady disclosure means is that information has to be turned over to the prosecutor, who then in turn has to decide whether or not a judge should examine it in an in-camera hearing. The judge then has to decide that it should be turned over to the defendant, who then has to decide whether or not they should use that type of evidence. And then if they use it, then it has to be effectively used. It has to actually impact whether a criminal case or how a criminal case is going to come out before there should be any impact on the officer's employment status. And so we see some law enforcement agencies taking that very measured approach, saying, look, just simply because you're designated as a Brady officer, that's not the end of the issue. Let's see how this thing plays out. And in fact, I know of law enforcement agencies where there's hundreds of officers who are on a Brady list or who have Brady designation. Other law enforcement agencies have reacted very differently. They've taken the position that if you're put on a Brady list, that's it. You're fired. You can't testify. You can't do the essential functions of the job. And they simply terminate officers. Now, that scenario has caused law enforcement officers to, on several occasions, sue prosecutors for wrongfully placing them on a Brady list. And to date, those lawsuits, at least where there's lawsuits for damages, those lawsuits have been unsuccessful. Courts have ruled that prosecutors are shielded by a principle known as prosecutorial immunity. Now, embedded in all of this is a fear, and sometimes it is overtly stated, and sometimes it's below the surface, a fear by law enforcement officers and their labor organizations that there will be some degree of collusion between a police chief or a sheriff who simply wants to get rid of an officer, who will go across the street to the prosecutor and say, hey, here's something that's going on with this officer, put him on the Brady list. There's not been any litigation over that I've seen until this month. And we have this bombshell case come out of Texas. I'm going to briefly describe it now because I'm going to try to get one of the lawyers on this podcast because I think this case is important enough. You may know that about once every other month, I'll do an interview with somebody who's usually involved in litigation that's has some national impact. And I'm going to try to get one of the lawyers on this podcast. His name is Randy Dubrava. He's the lawyer for the officer who sort of shepherded the whole thing through. So I don't want to steal too much of Randy's thunder, but I do want to tell you a little bit about this case. This involves the Georgetown, Texas Police Department and an officer by the name of Stephanie Brown. Brown ends up in a failed relationship with a fellow named Eric Poteet. And Poteet then makes allegations against Brown. And he says two things. She used my prescription medication, and also she used mescaline. The chief of police, a fellow named Wayne Nero, concluded that both of those allegations by Poteet were true, and also that Brown had been untruthful when questioned about her use of drugs. And the chief fired her in June of 2013. Now, in Texas, they kind of have a different phrase sometimes for firing, and the phrase is indefinitely suspended, meaning you can't ever come back to work. So I treat that as the equivalent of a discharge. Brown appeals under the Texas civil service law. She appeals to an independent hearing examiner. And while the hearing is pending, the chief meets with the local district attorney and the local county attorney and tells them what his conclusions were about Brown's alleged misconduct. And in response, the prosecutor sent a joint letter to the chief informing him that their offices would no longer accept cases for prosecution in which Brown has played a role. That's not just placement on a Brady list. That's saying we're just simply not going to prosecute anything in which she was involved. Then the hearing examiner makes his decision, and his decision under Texas law is final and binding, and he ends up concluding that two of the three charges against Brown weren't proven. First of all, she didn't use mescaline, he said, and secondly, she wasn't untruthful. She did use prescription drugs that belonged to Poteet. However, she had her own prescription for the drugs and the prescription had run out or whatever, and the hearings officer concludes that Brown did not use the drugs for recreational purposes. He ends up deciding that the termination should be reversed, that it should be converted to a 15-day suspension because technically she did violate the rules, and he orders her reinstated with all back pay and benefits. So on November 7th, 2013, Brown gets this award and shows up for work. That's November 7th. On November 8th, the city fires Brown again. And this time, Chief Nero explains that because the county attorney and the district attorney had decided never to use Brown as a witness anymore, Brown could no longer fulfill one of the essential job functions for being a police officer, testifying in court proceedings. The chief also labeled what he was doing as a non-disciplinary termination, which means to the chief, you have no rights to appeal this. So Brown can't go to a hearings officer again because the chief is refusing to participate in that process. So she sues the city, looking for a declaratory judgment that her termination was in fact a disciplinary action, which triggers her appeal rights under the civil service laws, and also wants a finding from the court that the city wrongfully terminated her employment. And that dispute goes to the Texas Court of Appeals. And the court is really, really offended at what it is the police chief had done here. And I'm going to read you a paragraph in the court's opinion. It's a short paragraph. Bear with me, but it really shows the degree to which the court, I think, was pretty upset. The court says, it doesn't appear that Brown's termination actually did relate to her qualifications. The city has presented no evidence that she was incapable of testifying or performing any other required function. She wasn't fired because she failed to maintain a license, pass an exam, or perform satisfactorily in the field. Rather, the evidence showed that the prosecutor's decision not to accept her cases was based on the chief's accusations of untruthfulness, which the hearing examiner found to be groundless. And instead of abiding by the hearing examiner's award, Chief Nero allowed the unilateral decision of elected officials to circumvent the protections of the Civil Service Act. Strong language, right? I got to read you another couple of sentences. According to the city, prosecutors have unbridled discretion to declare that they will not accept cases from an officer, and the chief may, in fact, has a duty to terminate that officer. Furthermore, according to the city, this termination is completely insulated from review by anyone, civil service commissioner, a commission, a hearing examiner, or the courts. This cannot be how the Civil Service Act works, as this interpretation would allow the defendants, the city, to nullify Brown's right of appeal merely by relabeling her termination as non-disciplinary. So the appeals court sends the case back down to a trial court for a hearing, and it's kind of tough to tell from the appeals court opinion exactly what that hearing is going to look like, but it sounds very much like the direction the appeals court is giving is, first of all, Brown needs to have appeals rights, and secondly, the notion that being placed on this super Brady list can be the basis for termination, that's off the table as a justification for the city's termination of her. As I said, I'll be talking with one of the lawyers who handled this case, I hope. We'll find out how this case is going on. But this is a big deal. This is a court allowing a police officer to get into the nature of the communication between the department and prosecuting authorities. The court examines that communication and finds that it was inappropriate, finds that the accusations of untruthfulness were groundless, or rather the hearings examiner finds that and the court accepts it. That's a rare instance that we see a court doing this. This follows hard on the heels of that New Hampshire case from last month that I was talking about, where a police officer or two police officers actually convinced a state Supreme Court to order prosecutors to remove an officer from a Brady list. Courts are increasingly finding that this Brady designation is incredibly harsh, and they are finding that local law enforcement authorities, employers, and prosecuting authorities aren't doing everything they should to procedurally protect police officers in these processes. More to come, you can bet on it. While we're talking about these procedural issues, the Brady issue, now there have become four rules of disciplinary procedure for public safety employees that that really, they're all known by their name, and they're just basic rules that I think every public safety employee, police officer, deputy sheriff, firefighter, correctional officer, they need to understand these rules. When you hear these names, you need to be paying attention to them. Brady is one of them. The rule in Garrity versus New Jersey is another. The third is how Miranda, that basic custodial interrogation case of the Supreme Court, applies in an employment context. And the fourth is the Weingarten rule, which is the right to representation in a disciplinary interview. You could argue there's a fifth rule, procedural due process, is required by the Supreme Court's decision in the Loudermill case, but There's very few disputes, meaningful disputes these days about Loudermill rights. Boy, that's not the case, though, with the other four rules. Let's talk about a couple of cases now. Both of them, coincidentally, are from New York. One is a Weingarten case and one's a Garrity case, and both decided in the last few days, and they're just, I think they illustrate some pretty important principles. Let's talk about the Weingarten case first. The Weingarten rule, simply stated, is that a public employee or a employee has the right to union representation if they are being questioned about a matter which the employee reasonably believes could result in discipline. So, does the employee reasonably believe that questioning could result in discipline? If so, then there's the right to union representation if the employee asks for it. Weingarten is not self-executing. The employee actually has to invoke their Weingarten rights. Well, there's been a lot of litigation over the last few years around a subset of the Weingarten rule. And the subset is, does a witness have Weingarten rights? So, in other words, is there some sort of distinction between whether the employee is the subject of the investigation, where I think everybody would say they have Weingarten rights to representation, and where the employer is merely designating them as a witness, where they might not have Weingarten rights? Is there some sort of line, and how do you draw it? Here's the case that comes out of New York. It's a correctional case. It involves a corrections officer by the name of Ian Wolf, and everything I'm about to tell you occurs in 2012. In July of 2012, Wolf becomes he is a witness to a use of force incident involving other correctional officers. That's in July. In November, he gets notice several days in advance that he is about to be questioned by a fellow named Gary Simpson, who is the special assistant to the commissioner of the New York State Correctional System. This is somebody way high up in the chain of command. Simpson does not tell Wolf the subject matter of the meeting, but Wolf is pretty sure it's about the July use of force incident because he was aware that several officers had been questioned and placed on administrative leave regarding the incident. Now, what happened in the incident? Well, here's what Wolf saw. This was an incident that involved a relocation of an inmate from one place to another. And at one point, Wolf left to retrieve a key to a shower door. When he returned, the inmate was escorted out of his cell, and Wolf observed that the inmate had a swollen right eye with a cut above it. Wolf didn't report the incident, didn't file any report, even though the department's rules require employees to report threatening behavior or inappropriate conduct. So when Wolf sits down with Simpson for this questioning, he asks Simpson, "Am I the target or a potential target of disciplinary action? And if so, I want my union rep." You can just imagine here, it's not in the opinion, so I'm kind of sort of making this up. No, I'm really making this up. But you can imagine. Wolf's union has distributed to all of their employees those advice of rights cards that the employees keep in their wallets. You know those cards, the ones that say on the top, what do you do if you're questioned about something that could result in discipline? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, get in touch with your union rep, that sort of thing. You can just imagine that Wolf is reading from one of those cards. So he says, "I want union rep if I'm going to be a target or a potential target." Simpson responds that union representation is, his words, not warranted because the department had no reason to believe that Wolf was a target, and I'm quoting, "at that time." Simpson's questioning begins with some pretty basic procedural questions. Pretty soon, Wolf starts to get confused by the questions, and It's not clear exactly what's going on. We don't have the Q&A listed in the opinion, but he gets confused. And he starts asking Simpson to repeat or rephrase the questions, telling Simpson, look, I don't understand the terminology that you're using. Simpson's response was to roll his eyes and eventually said, I'm quoting again, you sound like a politician now. Wolf responds by saying, look, am I being interrogated? I want my union. In fact, he asked for his union rep three separate times during this interview. And Simpson says, you're not entitled to union representation. Wolf describes Simpson's tone and demeanor as varying at different times during the course of the interview. Sometimes Simpson's voice is raised. Sometimes the tone of his voice changes. And sometimes he says things, are you sure you don't want to change your answer? And one time he says, don't play games with me and I won't play games with you. All is said and done. The questioning ends. And Wolf's labor organization, which is the New York State Correctional Officers and PBA, files an unfair labor practice complaint saying, hey, Weingarten violation. The employer's answer is, it's not a Weingarten violation because Wolf, in fact, was a witness. We didn't charge him with anything. He was a witness, and all we were doing was engaging in witness preparation when Simpson met with Wolf. This goes to an administrative law judge for New York's Public Employment Relations Board, and he finds a Weingarten violation. And what the administrative law judge says is it's not the employer's designation that controls on whether or not an employee has a right to representation. It's rather whether the employee reasonably believes that discipline could result from the questioning. And the administrative law judge says, we're going to take a lot of factors into account. This is a wonderful list of factors, by the way. I just love that the administrative law judge set this all out. He says, we're going to look at the subject matter and the context of the questioning, the statements that were given by the employer prior to the questioning, the verbal exchange between the rep for the employer and the employee during the interview, and the tone and content of that exchange, the timing and venue of the questioning, and the treatment of other employees who may have been involved in the incident. And the judge says, look, that's a list. It's not an exhaustive list, but it, and I'm quoting, underscores the importance of clarity and communications by an employer at the outset and during the questioning of the employee. So what about Wolf? Does Wolf reasonably believe that discipline could result? And the judge says, yes, he did, and cites several things. The judge says Wolf was informed that he was going to be questioned by Simpson. This is a high-ranking employee. That is suggestive of a disciplinary implication. He was not told why he was being questioned, but he knew that others who were somehow involved in this incident had been disciplined. That, too, is suggestive of the fact that Wolf could be disciplined. And also, there's this rule out there that employees have an obligation to make reports in situations like the one Wolf was in when he witnessed part of the incident in July. Wolf could reasonably believe he would be disciplined for violating that rule. What about the witness preparation argument that the employer makes here? Here's what the administrative law judge says. He says, look, I agree. The questioning of Wolf wasn't an interrogation, at least as that term is used by the parties here, but it can't be labeled a witness preparation. And now I'm going to read you a couple of sentences from the judge's opinion. The judge says, although the interrogation, the questioning, had elements of witness preparation and may partially have served that purpose or may have been originally intended for that purpose, It also functioned as a fishing expedition on the part of Simpson, who admittedly entered the interview not fully comprehending what role Wolf may have played in the use of force incident. Also, on at least two occasions, the interview metamorphosized, that's a tough word to pronounce, metamorphosized, into questioning about Wolf's conduct as opposed to questions regarding what he saw or witnessed others doing. End of issue, says the judge. Wolf reasonably believed that he could be subject to disciplinary action and thus had the right to a union rep under Weingarten. And by the way, that's the way these cases come out around the country. I can think of cases in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and one in California, one in Oregon, all come out the same way. That there is no witness subject or witness suspect dichotomy in these Weingarten cases. Rather, it's what the employee reasonably believes. It's not the employer's designation that controls. Now, I mentioned that we also have a Garrity case that comes to us from New York. It's a odd case procedurally, because it's one of the few cases where you see a court make a decision and then reconsider its decision, withdraw its prior opinion, and go the other way entirely. In other words, it's the judicial equivalent of saying, oops. And that's what happens in this criminal case. It's a criminal prosecution of a New York City corrections officer this time, a guy named Gregory Grabowski. And he's charged with a lot of stuff criminally. He's indicted for, and it all comes out of the job, assault in the third degree, offering a false instrument for filing, meaning he's falsifying documents, falsifying business records, official misconduct, and other related charges. The key issue that the court is concerned with is a statement that Grabowski made to the city of New York's Department of Investigation. And the question is, was that statement a compelled statement under Garrity? And in the first opinion that the court wrote, the one it withdrew, it said it's not a compelled statement because the employer's representatives, the Department of Investigation, never ordered the employee to give a statement. In its latest opinion, the court lays out that there are two tests that are used to decide whether or not an employee is accorded Garrity rights, whether or not, in the parlance of the Fifth Amendment, the employee can be considered to be compelled to answer a question. And what are those two tests? The first is whether or not the employee believed that they could be fired for refusing to answer questions. And the second part of the test is, was that belief reasonable? Was, you know, would a reasonable employee, and Garrity applies to all public employees, would a reasonable employee in those circumstances have believed that unless they made a statement, unless they answered questions, that they could be fired for doing so? So the court then turns to Grabowski's situation and whether or not Grabowski reasonably believed that he could be disciplined for refusing to answer questions from the Department of Investigation. And the court starts by saying, Grabowski testified. He said he thought he would be fired. I find that testimony credible. And therefore, the first part of that two-part test is met. Now, was that belief by Grabowski a reasonable one? And the court says yes. Why? Here's why, and I'm going to read you a few sentences again from the court's opinion. It is uncontested that Grabowski was never told by any of the investigators that he was free to leave and that he would face no consequences if he refused to speak to the investigators. Further, Grabowski's demeanor of extreme nervousness during the course of the interview was that of an inexperienced interviewee who believed his job was at stake. The fact that he spoke freely to the investigators for an hour and didn't try to consult an attorney also indicates that he believed that his statements could not be used against him in a criminal prosecution, and that belief was reasonable, says the court. Why? The court points to the fact that a captain was present, as well as three Department of Investigations investigators. And one of the questioners, in fact, was also a captain. The court says, in a paramilitary organization such as the Department of Corrections, where cooperation with supervisors is expected, Grabowski would reasonably believe he had no choice but to answer or be severely disciplined. In addition, there's signs all over Grabowski's workplace. He works at Rikers Island Prison. Signs that direct corrections officers like Grabowski to report corruption. And they say that the Department of Investigations won't be the one that is investigating corruption charges. It'll be another agency. And therefore, the Department of Investigation is thought of by corrections officers as investigating potential disciplinary events. That could lead a corrections officer, when approached in the field by investigators, to believe that he either had to talk or be fired. Therefore, Garrity applies. The statement is suppressed in the criminal proceedings, even though the employer never gave a direct order to the employee to answer the questions. Now, in this case is notable, as I said, because the court actually changes its mind on that. But the place where it ends up has long been the law. This two-part test goes back dozens of years and has been applied in dozens of Garrity cases by courts all over the country. So the ending place of this opinion, I think, is the right place, at least in terms of consistency with where Garrity protections exist out there. And there's a message in there for employers that I think employers really need to listen to. And that is, you can actually accidentally give somebody Garrity immunity without intending to do so, unless you make it clear at the start of the interview that the employee statement is completely voluntary and is not compelled, and that no harm will come to them if they refuse to answer your questions. You're running a risk that the employee will reasonably believe that discipline could result from failing to answer your questions. And if the employee reasonably believes that, you've immunized the employee, or immunize their statements and the fruits of their statements. So there's a training moment here for employers in this case. And the training moment is, be careful that if you're going to immunize people under Garrity, that you do it deliberately rather than accidentally. Okay, let's shift over to the other side of the country and talk about a California firefighter and a presumptive causation case. What do I mean by presumptive causation? Most states in the country have laws, have statutes, workers' compensation, pension statutes, that say that certain types of conditions suffered by certain public employees, more on all that later, are presumed to be work-related conditions. These originally were called heart-lung bills, because they applied to heart conditions and lung conditions. And originally, they applied mostly to firefighters, although increasingly, they have been expanded in both areas. They have been expanded to include other types of conditions. For example, they include, many of them include cancers, and some include hepatitis and even HIV. And also, they've been applied to public safety employees other than firefighters. So you see some of them applying to police officers, for example. It's all on a state-by-state basis as to whether you have a presumptive causation rule and as to who it applies to and the types of conditions that it applies to. What does a presumptive causation law do? And let's talk about the California one, since this is a California case, and it's It's a very, very typical presumptive causation law. And this one applies to cancer, and this is a firefighter who suffers from cancer. This law says that if you have a firefighter who has completed 5 or more years of service, and that firefighter develops cancer, and now I'm going to quote from the statute, the cancer so developing or manifesting itself in those cases shall be presumed to arise out of and in the course of employment. The presumption is disputable and may be controverted by evidence that the carcinogen to which the member has demonstrated exposure is not reasonably linked to the disabling cancer. So in other words, we call it a presumptive causation because all that this sort of statute does is to create a presumption. It's not indisputable evidence. It can be rebutted by the employer. And that's what James Haskin, who's a firefighter for Kern County, California, that's what James Haskins faced in this case. He began to work for the fire department in 1978. He responded to over 3,000 calls during his 33-year tenure. 842 of those calls were for medical aid, and 981 of them were for fires, whether they were vehicle fires or refuse fires or wildland fires or whatever. In the course of responding to those fires, Haskins was exposed to a lot of different chemicals and substances. He was exposed to, for example, diesel truck fumes that include methylene chloride, pesticides, herbicides, soot, products of various combustions, including PCBs and PVCs and cadmium, burning plant. Well, you get it. He was a firefighter for almost 35 years, and he was exposed to just about everything you could be exposed to. Haskins was diagnosed with cancer in October of 2007, prostate cancer, when he was 51 years old. And in September of 2010, 3 years later, he went on industrial leave and applied for a service-connected disability. That was opposed by the county, and the case made it up to the California Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals upheld the county's decision to reject the claim. And the court found that the county had successfully rebutted the presumption that the prostate cancer arose out of Haskins' job. And here's what the court says. For each of the potential exposures to which Haskins testified, a doctor provided medical evidence via medical studies to show the particular exposure was not reasonably linked to prostate cancer. And in other words, the employer did, if you're going to be defending one of these cases from the employer's standpoint, this is the sort of approach you need to take. It's not enough to call a doctor who says, I don't think it was caused by that. You need to call a doctor who will say, okay, I've looked at all of the specific exposures and chemicals to which the employee was exposed, and those cannot be reasonably linked to this particular condition. So it's more than a generalized belief couldn't be caused by the job. You see some of these presumptive causation cases involving, for example, I can think of a case from earlier this year from the Washington Court of Appeals involving a doctor who got on the witness stand and said that a firefighter's lung condition was not related to the job because this doctor didn't believe that this particular lung condition had on-the-job causes. He believed that that lung condition was hereditary. And the court said, not good enough. You need more than just you getting on the stand and saying, hey, I'm a doctor, and I basically believe that the statute is wrong, that there shouldn't be presumptive causation. What you need, if you're an employer, is what the doctor in Haskins' case did. And the court says, concludes its opinion by saying, we think that the doctor's testimony is sufficient to demonstrate that Haskins' work-related carcinogenic exposures were not reasonably linked to the development of his prostate cancer. This is just a reminder for everybody that these are presumptive causation laws. They're not conclusive causation laws. It's just a presumption. And both sides, the employer that wants to deny a workers' comp claim and the employee that wants to pursue it, had better be ready to get down into the weeds, into links between the particular condition and on-the-job exposures. Let's stay in California for a moment, talk about a new Bill of Rights case coming out of California. The last one I talked about was the firefighter Bill of Rights case. This is a police case. And the question is, does the Bill of Rights, does the California, its peace officers' Bill of Rights, it's actually has a more complicated name, but let's just call it Bill of Rights, does it apply to an independent investigation done by a district attorney's office? And this is a case that comes out of Scotts Valley, and in particular, a fellow by the name of Sergeant Mark Lopez, who was the chairman and president of what's called the Scotts Valley POA Charitable Foundation. The POA ran an annual fundraiser called Cops and Rotters, which raised funds that were distributed to local organizations and award scholarships. In 2012, a fellow officer to Lopez told the department's police chief that he thought Lopez was embezzling funds from the POA and the charitable foundation's work. Among the things that Ball says were that Lopez had written a check to pay for his water bill, a POA check for his water bill, and had written several $500 checks for a scholarship for his daughter that were not properly authorized through the POA. The police chief decides, too touchy. This is officer on officer. It involves matters dealing with the internal functioning of the union. I don't want to investigate this. And so what he does is to ask the local district attorney's office to investigate for potential criminal charges. And he wants a neutral third party conducting the investigation. Now, early on, there are two investigators, one named Rivera and the other Rowe. Rivera and Rowe meet with the police chief and meet with a police department lieutenant to update the department about the progress of their investigation. At that meeting, neither the chief nor the lieutenant made any attempt to control or direct the investigation, and Rivera tells tells everybody he can that I am working for the district attorney's office, and I am not going to take direction from the department. Well, finally, it comes time to interview Sergeant Lopez, who's the accused, and this happens in October of 2012. The investigators meet with the lieutenant, who does work for the department, and they say, look, we're going to interview Lopez. We want him disarmed before we interview him. The lieutenant agrees, calls Lopez in, and disarms him. And Lopez complies with the request that he be disarmed. He didn't get any notice from anybody that he was going to be interviewed that day. Very quickly, Wilson leaves. Wilson tells Lopez that investigators from the DA's office want to talk to you. He says, I'm going to be outside in the hall. They want to talk to you. It's not me. Wilson, who's the lieutenant, doesn't explain to Lopez that he's being investigated for embezzlement. He is not told why he's being questioned, anything of that sort. So now we have the two DA investigators, Rivera and Rowe, in a room with Lopez. They do not compel him to give a statement, and the lieutenant had not compelled him to give a statement. They don't give him any advice of his rights under California's Bill of Rights, and they just go ahead and conduct the investigation. The DA's office eventually, when it's all done, decides not to prosecute Lopez, but the city fires him for embezzlement. And Lopez then challenges his termination, saying that the Bill of Rights was violated in the way that he was interviewed. And the California Court of Appeals says, no, it wasn't, because the Bill of Rights, and this would be true, by the way, in or out of California, I think every Bill of Rights that I've read, this would be true. Bill of Rights doesn't apply to any interrogation of a public safety officer, nor does it apply to an investigation that is aimed at alleged criminal activities. And here, the DA's office doesn't have the ability to discipline or terminate Lopez. It's an outside agency. It's not subject to the Bill of Rights. And it's very clear from the facts of this case that the investigation that was done by Rivera and Rowe was independent of the police department. About all they did was try to coordinate with the police department on the scheduling and the circumstances of Lopez's interview. So bottom line, since this investigation was independent and not a joint effort, the Bill of Rights doesn't apply, and the court affirms Lopez's termination. Not an unexpected result here, given the way this investigation was done. Just as I mentioned, the last case, or last couple of cases, provide sort of a training or a teaching moment for employers. This is a training or teaching moment for unions and employees. What should Lopez have done here? Lopez, the president of the union, well, what should he have done? He should have asked Rivera and Rowe, am I compelled to answer these questions? And if the answer is yes, Lopez should have said, I want my representation. If the answer was no, Lopez should have said, been an interesting afternoon, I'll see you guys later, and walked out of the room. That is how a union should be training its employees to react to something like this. But that's not what happened. What happened is that Lopez actually answered the questions, and as a result, and because of his conduct, ended up losing his job. Let's travel back across the country for the last case I want to talk about. This is a case out of New Jersey. It's a free speech case, and I just want to use it to point out to you that what we know as the Garcetti Rule marches on and is alive and well. The Garcetti Rule comes to us from a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2006, and in that case, the court held that if a public employee engages in speech, so if they say something or they write something, a memo or whatever it is, and the speech is part of their job, the First Amendment gives them no protection. And the employer is free to retaliate against the employee, even fire the employee, even if the speech is completely true. Now, Garcetti, this rule has resulted in hundreds of police officers, firefighters, deputies, public safety employees, losing their free speech claims, and many times losing their jobs because they don't have any other job protection. Now, you know, most public safety employees do have other job protections. They may have grievance procedures or hearings boards that they can appeal to, but we tend to forget that not everybody has those job rights. And some employees, the First Amendment is all they have. And also, the First Amendment gives by far the best remedies. You know, you can get all sorts of damages under the First Amendment that an arbitrator or civil service board would never award you, wouldn't have the power to award you. Well, this Garcetti rule, when it was announced by the Supreme Court, there were all sorts of prophecies as to how this was a fundamental change in free speech law in the country. And that's proven true. It has been, one federal court of appeals described it as a revolution in free speech law. Because in the past, speech that arose out of a public safety officer's job, that was thought to be protected. And not just protected, but given the highest levels of protection under the First Amendment. Why? Because it's a matter of public interest. how a public safety agency runs. Sometimes the speech was whistleblowing speech, which is thought to be the most protected speech. And what the Supreme Court said in Garcetti is, we don't even get to the issue of whether the speech is about something of public importance. We just ask whether or not the speech arose out of the employee's job. And if it did, it's not protected. No matter how important it is, no matter how true it is, it's not protected. And that's a lesson that Walter Young, who's a lieutenant, was a lieutenant in the Irvington, New Jersey Police Department, learned the hard way. Young, what was Young's speech? He filed a complaint. He filed a complaint against his police chief. By the way, memo to all lieutenants out there, filing complaints against a police chief, an IA complaint, not always likely to end well for you, okay? Well, Young filed a complaint against the chief, and he alleged that the chief had engaged in improper sexual relationships with subordinates. In fact, he points to an island vacation that a fairly new female police officer took with the chief, and immediately on coming back was promptly promoted to a detective, the new police officer. And he points to other relationships. And these are all allegations. We don't know from the court's opinion whether any of this stuff is true. So after he does all this, then we have an event that occurs on March 14th, 2010. Young, he's a lieutenant, he's the desk supervisor on duty, and a sergeant comes to him and says, "Hey, I saw an officer sleeping on two occasions while he was guarding downed electrical lines. And I talked to the officer about it. He told me he had taken some sort of sleep aid prior to reporting for duty." Young, the lieutenant again, questions the officer, puts him on sick leave, and orders the sergeant to initiate a disciplinary investigation and notifies Internal Affairs that this has all occurred. You might think that Young acted appropriately, but in fact, he was fired for his response to this incident. Among other things, fired for not insisting that the officer take a drug test. Young had a justification for that. He said, "I looked at the officer. He didn't seem lethargic or agitated or unsteady. I didn't see anything unusual about his behavior, but nonetheless, he's fired." He then files a free speech lawsuit and says, "Retaliation. I was fired because I filed the Internal Affairs complaints about the chief's romantic escapades with female subordinates." And the city's answer is, "What do you mean? First Amendment doesn't apply here because of the Garcetti rule." That case goes up to the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which agrees with the city. Why? Here's the key paragraph in the court's opinion. Young did not speak as a private citizen when he filed the complaints. It was part of Young's ordinary job duties as a lieutenant in the Irvington Police Department to file an internal affairs complaint stating that the chief of police showed favoritism to another officer because of a sexual relationship between the chief and the officer's sister. Without more, a complaint about interdepartmental favoritism falls squarely within the realm of personal grievances as opposed to speech implicating a matter of public concern. Therefore, the speech not protected. It was part of Young's job, part of any police officer's job, to file an internal affairs complaint if they suspect another police officer of any rank of misconduct, and therefore their speech isn't protected. Even if the allegation in the complaint, what the officer said, in this case Young is saying the police chief is actually, you know, violating accepted procedures violating what we would expect to see occur in a police department by his treatment of these subordinates. Having the relationship with them, promoting one of them, even though that may be a matter of public interest. If the speech arises out of the job, it's not protected under the Garcetti rule. What this has done, this Garcetti rule has done, is to channel complaints about violation of what we would think to be retaliation, anti-retaliation provisions. It channels them into other forums than federal court. So we will see them, for example, labeled as whistleblowing complaints filed under a whistleblowing statute. We'll see them litigated in state court rather than federal court, and we'll see them litigated in grievance procedures under a collective bargaining agreement. Because if they're in federal court and they're under the Garcetti rule, they fail. We just released the 7th edition of my book on the rights of law enforcement officers. There's a free speech chapter in there. And in putting it together, I tried to read all the published opinions in the last 6 years on police officers and free speech cases. I'm about to give you a number that I'm completely making up because I didn't actually count, but I'd be shocked if police officers won more than even 1% of free speech lawsuits that they file. That it's overwhelming that the Garcetti rule has resulted in police officers losing their free speech rights, and not just police officers, public employees losing their free speech rights about any speech that they make associated with the job. There's a bit of an exception. I do want to end with this. The exception to the Garcetti rule is when you take your firefighter or police officer hat off and put your union official hat on. Garcetti doesn't apply to union speech, and union officials are able to get First Amendment protection for speech about the job, as long as they make it clear it's union speech. But that's a very minor, minor exception. Okay, with that, I've reached my witching hour here. I try to keep these things under an hour. Unfortunately, I didn't get through all of the cases, but I will try to pick up the ones I didn't get to next month. With that, I hope you have a good pre-Christmas or Thanksgiving period, and look forward to seeing you in our December First Thursday podcast. And do listen for an interview on that Texas Brady case. I think that's going to be a really good one. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.